This is the Preservation Technology Podcast, bringing innovation to preservation. The Preservation Technology Podcast is a production of the National Center for Preservation Technology and Training, a unit of the National Park Service.
My name's Dr. Catherine Cooper. I am here with
Sophie Ziegler, an oral historian of the Louisiana Trans Oral History Project. Pronouns are they, them. So excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for joining us. So can you tell us a bit about the Louisiana Trans Oral History Project and how it started?
So we started in May of 2020. The pandemic was already going. So it was two motivations. One was to fill a perceived gap in the documentation of Louisiana-centered trans and gender nonconforming communities. And the other motivation was the crippling isolation of the pandemic. Some of us just got really lonely. I started looking around for some sort of project to join and help out with. I assumed something like this would exist. I couldn't find that it did. So I reached out to just a couple of friends and said, hey, I'm thinking about doing this. If I do, like, would you want to interview? Would you want to be part of this? And I got several immediate yeses, right? Had people been skeptical, I probably wouldn't have done it. Simultaneously, I reached out to the T. Harry Williams Oral History Center here at LSU because they do a lot of community work. And so that's my colleague at LSU, Jen Kramer. I told her about what I was thinking about doing, and she does what that center does. A lot of sort of helped me get up to speed on what oral histories are, like best practices for that. That center shares their forms, right? Interviewee and interviewer permission forms. We talked about what informed consent would look like and all of these things. And then I just sort of ran off and started. So since March of 2020, we've had about 40 interviews, I think. That's always going to be an inexact number because during the process, there's always people who fall out or ask to be removed. But so we've been going since then. We had an LEH, Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities grant for 2020, in which we were able to do a lot of events, pay trans folks in Louisiana to do transfers for us, pay people to do events. So really what we're interested in doing is bringing in money and redistributing it to our communities. And then I got another, whatever year this is now, we got another LEH grant, which we'll start working on in January of 22. And that's going to allow us to do some really great things, including building a participatory map in which we can rethink the geography of Louisiana through the lens of trans joy. So we'll be redistributing funds to our community members around the state, asking them to record a short oral history about some place that elicited trans joy. And there was like a video of that uploaded to the map, and this would just be an ongoing project, which we're very excited about. And then we're gonna be holding a Joy Fest in probably June-ish, in which we get everyone together and we talk about trans joy, and which is, you know, a reaction to just how terrible everything is all the time. We're just gonna make our own joy. My day job is dealing with paper archives primarily, and then running a team that digitizes that, and then managing digital repositories. I have a sense of the infrastructure that's needed for that. And what I wanted was, one, to get around the dearth of materials that would be related to the types of people that I wanted to talk to. I also wanted a project that could be more or less independent and stay more or less independent. So we work with the T. Harry Williams Oral History Center, and they're sort of our community partner, but we're completely independent from them and everyone else in the institution, such as Louisiana State University. So oral history's kind of allowed us to do that. We've been doing everything over Zoom, which is not oral history best practice. It definitely wasn't when we started. I think they're kind of coming around because, you know, what else are you going to do? One, I just love oral histories because you get so much more unmitigated access to people. It's such a beautiful format. It is inexhaustible too, right? Because you could always go back to the same person, ask the exact same questions on a different day, and always get a different perspective. So their life shines through them in a lens that's always changing. And it's just so nice. It's also just a wonderful way to connect to people. And it makes a lot more sense for people not in the history game who don't really think a lot about records and leaving this type of legacy. It makes a lot more sense to say, hey, we're just going to sit down and talk because you're really interesting and you do really important things, versus whatever it would look like to try to collect the manuscript materials related to them, right? Because most of us are just leaving behind Google Docs. And yeah, there are very smart people figuring out how to, and God bless them. But I didn't want that for me. That's really, I guess, the focus on there.
So you see that it complements the archival record or the historical record by these personal stories.
Yeah, I mean, compliments for sure, but there's not a lot to actually compliment, right? Mm-hmm. So there's been a push recently here in Louisiana, elsewhere in the South, all over the country. It gets more attention in the South because the people don't expect it from us. But there's been sort of a push for like LGBTQ plus collecting in archives and libraries. But I mean, really, like what that looks like on the ground is mostly cis white gay men, cis white lesbians, mostly of a specific class during a couple of decades. Right. And you get these wonderful lesbian action pamphlets, which are just wonderful collections. But, I mean, those holes are just so big you can drive an archive through. And so it's just, like, kind of hard to think about what we could do that would work better. And I also want to say the goal of our oral history project is to, first and foremost, tell our stories to ourselves. So we are most interested in creating the types of examples that many of us wish we had when we were younger, right? Some of us die from lack of examples. Like, this is really, really important. Secondarily, we're telling our stories for other people. So the process for the oral histories, or people do an interview with us, we go through the whole transcription process. We get them to see the transcripts and okay everything, de-identify, et cetera, anything that didn't come off wrong. Or people just get carried away talking shit about somebody else. And then if they're interested after that, they can sign the paperwork to donate it to the T. Harry Williams Oral History Center. But those are two different things. Mm-hmm. So they can just work with us, have their interview up on our website, maybe do a podcast with us. But not everybody wants it in an official archive. That's really important, is we're not necessarily telling it for posterity. It's not necessarily history work.
It's for the community and preserving the community.
Yeah.
And strengthening it.
I mean, maybe not even preserving it, right? Like, because not everybody wants it for that long. So, like, it's just communicating right now. Like, things have been hard, right? So, like, the last legislative session saw 4 anti-trans bills come through. Just basically picking fights with trans youth, because they're still one of the, like, the groups that you can do that as a politician and really rally your base without getting attacked for it. So it's like, it's just a really tough time, which is why we're focusing on trans joy. So the number one reason for doing it is, like, survival. It's very much like a here and now thing. With, hey, wouldn't it be nice if these stuck around forever? And again, like, some people are just like, I don't want to do that part.
So is there a residence time of the interviews on your website for people who might not want it around forever, but just for the now?
Do you mean like a sunset?
Yeah.
No. We have at least 2 people who said, I will probably contact you soon to take it down. So there's not like anything set. I get the sense that they have life plans such that there'll be a time where they really don't want that up. And that has all sorts of practical ramifications for how we deal with it. So it's on the website. It's totally accessible right now. But that means we have to have conversations with them about the Wayback Machine, capturing that. People reach out, like the Transgender Digital Archive, the big online Transgender Digital Archive, who would like to repurpose the oral histories and like also have them, you know, as part of it. You can search and find them on their site, which I love, but we can't just do it as a blank slate. We have to deal with each individual oral history separately because the intentions are different.
Could you walk us through some of the important terms that folks may not be as aware of and how they're used or vary in use in the trans and queer communities?
You know, I've done all the interviews so far. I've been trying to go out of my way to define as many terms as possible. Most of what people are likely to find right now, I think, are pretty understandable. So maybe some people might trip over the word cis, which is just meaning somebody who's not trans. There are various sex acts, which we'll just leave it for people's imagination at this point. But, I mean, for the most part, there's not a whole lot. There's a lot of identities that are shifting, and our vocabularies for them are shifting, right? So, like, genderqueer, obviously the non-binary and the binary woman, and a lot of that type of thing. And so one of the decisions we have to make is whether or not to have a glossary on the website. And we opted to not. One, because a glossary for a group of words that change so often, it's sort of a big undertaking. But also, secondly, because we had to make the decision that we're not doing Trans 101. There are plenty of resources out there. But because, again, if you think about who our community is, that's just not energy that makes any sense to expend on that. But I think the identities, because we do ask people how they identify currently during the day that we're talking.
Right.
And we just have a lot of wonderful things. Most of the pronouns are what you'd expect to hear, he, she, they, them. But, you know, pronouns shift also. I guess, if anything, it wouldn't be specific vocabularies. It might be, I wonder if one of the challenges, so some people use any pronouns with respect. So you can have a single story about one individual and they have multiple pronouns mm-hmm. throughout, which I think is lovely, personally. But I can see why that might be a little hard to follow if you're not used to it. But we do bracket notes and stuff like that. Try to make it easy.
And each individual may define the terms for themselves differently.
Oh, yes.
Do you get into that a bit when you talk to people?
It really depends. So it's tricky, right? So this is an identity-based project. But we're always concerned, if you've got a trans person who's also another thing, they're like, hey, that trans librarian. So it's always this sort of tension. It depends on whether or not they want to talk about it. Some people, like, we do coming out stories sometimes. We do, like, gender journey stories sometimes. But some people just aren't that into talking about that. And are much more interested in talking about their community work that they do, for instance. Which totally makes sense. So it really just depends.
So can you share a bit about what the interview process is like and how you develop the questions and how the conversations may go?
We have a sign-up form on the website. So that's just step one, where we get the names and the pronouns that they want to use for this project. And then we ask them a question on that form. What does being trans in Louisiana mean to you? And it's really the answer to that question that leads to a lot of the conversation that we have. Especially on the earlier interviews, I would just read their answers back to them and then just ask questions about it. Like, oh, you know, you said this. And of course, by then, they don't know this. I do light research on folks, especially people who are, like, very active. You know, like, I would just build sort of, not specific questions, but, like, broad ideas that I hope we talk about. So, like, for instance, if they're very active in an organization, like Reproductive Justice, for instance, or Prison Abolition, like, you know, we might be able to talk about that and just ask them about that and ask them about how their relationship to power sort of influences their choice of work and how it is that they work. Most of the interviews we've done so far are sort of full life interviews. So we do actually start off with the way they were born. What it was like growing up there, if they want to talk about that. The requirement to participate is that you lived in Louisiana at some point. So it's geographically constrained, temporally rather open. And I did that on purpose. So I've interviewed people in like Virginia and like other states. And I do that on purpose because we're very interested in like what their perspectives and differences too, right? So what it looks like in Virginia versus what you did in Louisiana. Because we're just trying to paint, you know, a large picture of how their life is, what turns their life has taken given their existence in Louisiana. But, you know, based on their answers, you know, the questions or topics were always changing. So I leave it open. Generally, I end with a question about if you were to donate this, and it becomes like part of the quote unquote like official history of Louisiana, that is like in the archives, somebody runs across it in like 30 or 40 years. Like, what would you like that person to know about what it's like living your life here now? And so we generally end on a question like that, in which give a like a final opportunity for people to say anything that hadn't come up.
So what has been the most rewarding part of this project for you?
So I've met a lot of people, a lot of really wonderful people that I don't think I would have met before, or at least not as quickly. So many phenomenal people. So that's really rewarding. This was my first oral history project. I feel like having spent time doing oral histories, I now spend a lot of time listening to other oral history projects, podcasts created on that, books based on those. I feel like I've become a much better listener. I've become a lot more empathetic. It's just a lot easier to get outside of yourself. Especially when you're re-listening to these for transcript purposes. And, you know, you have the headphones on, it's just you and that person. It's rather intimate. So all of that's very rewarding. And then I'm particularly proud of the fact that we were able to bring in funds. So through the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, who's funded us twice so far, through a Patreon account, through just donors. And we take all this money. We're not an entity, we're not an LLC or nonprofit, so but we just take all this money and we just give it back out to all the communities here. So either to have them do panels, like we could pay everybody for that. Our podcast, we just finished the first season. It's very short, but I'm not good at podcasts. It was grueling. Every episode featured a trans artist from here in Louisiana, so we were able to pay them. This upcoming project, we're going to be able to pay the participants for the maps. So yeah, it's really good. So that's really rewarding because it's just an immediate, like actual tangible good.
So you mentioned that this project was kind of born out of the pandemic.
Yes.
Where do you see it going forward?
I don't know how long it's going to go. And that's because, like, the way that it's been formulated so far, it's me in my living room with a Zoom account. We've done a lot of amazing things, and we've, again, met a lot of wonderful people. But I'm white, I'm 40-ish, and, you know, with luck, middle-class-ish, right? So most of the people that I have contact with are more or less the same. So most of the people I've interviewed are white, a lot of trans films. So I've been making a lot of effort to work with other projects that's focused specifically on black and brown communities. So this most recent project that we got funding for at LEH is a joint project with Last Call NOLA, which is a long-going oral history project built originally on the Fading Dyke Bars scene in New Orleans. And so they were really focusing on that, and they are very multiracial, like intentionally multiracial, intentionally storytelling focused. So we're working very closely with my colleague Natalie Folk from that project. So I think what I would really prefer, and I've talked to a lot of other people who want to do interviews when we can do them in person. But I would like to decenter myself in the sense that, like, we just sort of dissolve the center of Latope, which is currently, again, me in my living room. Build capacity so that people can go around like this, like what you're doing now, and interview the elders that are, you know, important to them. And then we can centralize in whatever way that makes sense the interviews for access. So this was the model that the New York Trans Project did for a while. I think they might be rethinking it now. But the types of interviews you get would be very different. The types of questions asked were very different. For both good and challenging as that might be. I don't know how much longer we'll be doing these sort of full life interviews. We're doing another series currently based on trans resistance to the anti-trans bills from last season. So we're talking with a bunch of folks that we know who are really active in building resistance to that and building community around coming out for the protests and calling lawmakers and organizing around that. That's one direction we're going. And again, I'm working with a lot of different people. So it's not just a Latope project. We'll see what happens. I'm not that interested in making sure Latope survives. I'm much more interested in taking advantage of the connections that enabled to be able to do something potentially more impactful in the future. In the way that a lot of my interviewees and this is always so beautiful. So many people I've spoken with at the end of our interview will say something along the lines of, interviews like this often make it seem really bleak. And we know that there's a cultural narrative around transness that's tragic. But the amount of joy and resilience among the communities I've met, it's just, it's really empowering. And so for everybody who is donating these for long-term preservation, these interviews to Latope, that's really something that I want to shine through, right? So again, we're doing this for those of us alive right now in Louisiana, and those of us who are about, you know, currently coming out and having a really hard time here in the Deep South. Secondarily, we're doing it for the future, to have a source of non-tragic narrative. I think it's a really beautiful thing. And I'll leave it with that.
So if anyone is interested in reaching out to you...
Yes, absolutely. You can find us at LouisianaTransOralHistory.org is our website. We are on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. Yes. Yes, we are. And we'll have a lot to advertise during 2022. And I hope people participate, reach out with questions.
Thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you for this. This is great.
This was a presentation of the Preservation Technology Podcast, produced by the National Center for Preservation Technology and Training. To find more podcasts like this one, please visit our website,